of the Health and Human Services Finance Committee to order. Our subject for today is Medicaid Home and Community-Based Waiver Services. We will cover the very recent release from the Office of the Legislative Auditor report. And then we will also ask for response and perhaps even go a little further with the Department of Human Services and some of the new waivers that are being planned as a kind of a corollary to this. So that will be our topic for the day. Welcome to our committee, Jody Ha. Jody, if you'd introduce yourself for the record, please. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the Finance Committee. My name is Jody Hauer. I work for the Legislative Auditor's Office. This morning, I will describe for you the outcomes of our report released just yesterday on the Medicaid home and community-based waiver programs. The Medicaid waiver programs provide alternatives to institutionalization. They're primarily for certain groups of people who are eligible for Medicaid, who require long-term care of some sort, and for most of the programs, have certified disabilities. The programs are called waivers because they waive certain requirements that the regular state Medicaid plan would otherwise have to follow, such as requiring that any benefit offered be offered to all of the Medicaid beneficiaries. To operate the Medicaid waiver programs, states have to first receive approval from the federal government, from the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and have to meet the ongoing federal requirements for operating the waivers. In Minnesota, the Department of Human Services oversees the Medicaid waiver programs, but the counties around the state administer them. Now I'll briefly describe the five Medicaid waiver programs that Minnesota has. The largest of the five waiver programs is the mental retardation or related conditions waiver program, which accounts for 79% of all the spending on the MA waiver programs. You see it as the red slice of the pie on this particular figure. It's referred to as the MRRC waiver program, or sometimes called the DD waiver for developmental disabilities. Related conditions include conditions like cerebral palsy, autism, and other related syndromes that are specified in statute. You can see from this pie that the other four waiver programs are far smaller than the MRRC waiver program, but let me describe them briefly for you. The second largest is the elderly waiver program. It's shown in green in this particular chart. Second largest, it serves persons over the age of 65 who would otherwise require the level of care provided in nursing facilities. The next is the waiver called Community Alternatives for Disabled Individuals. It's for persons who have certified disabilities who require a nursing facility level of care. It's distinguished because it also includes persons who have physical disabilities or mental illnesses, unlike the MRRC waiver. The fourth is the Traumatic Brain Injury waiver. It's for persons with a traumatic or acquired brain injury who have significant cognitive and behavioral needs related specifically to that injury. These people require the level of care provided either in a nursing facility or in a specialized hospital known as a neurobehavioral hospital. And then finally, the fifth and certainly the smallest of Minnesota's five Medicaid waiver programs is the Community Alternative Care waiver. This waiver is for persons who are chronically ill or medically fragile. They require the care provided, level of care provided in a hospital. And the program right now has only about 132 persons enrolled. Now, our report provides some information on all five of these Medicaid waiver programs, but we focus most heavily on the MRRC waiver program. In our study, we looked at a variety of research questions, but the key ones are these. First, what are the factors that drive Minnesota's spending on the Medicaid waiver programs? And how have the waiver programs affected caseloads and spending for institutional care? Second, how well does the method Minnesota uses to allocate resources to counties for the MRRC waiver program work? Third, does the state have sufficient controls to ensure appropriate spending on the waiver program? And finally, how well do counties comply with certain state rules that govern how the MRRC waiver program operates? I'll start with information on expenditures. In fiscal year 2003, Minnesota spent just over $1 billion on the five Medicaid waiver programs. This represents an 11-fold increase over the past dozen years. Most of that spending, as I've already suggested, is on the MRRC waiver program, about $799 million in fiscal year 2003. The waiver programs represent a very sizable share of Minnesota's spending on medical assistance. In fact, they now account for 21% of all of the state's MA spending. This slide shows how waiver spending has changed over time. Each of these five red columns represents one of the waiver programs, and you can see how they compare to inflation and population growth, which is represented by that white horizontal line. Overall, the programs grew at an average annual rate of 23% each year. And you can see that inflation and population growth was the equivalent of about 4% each year. And for each of the programs, with the exception of the smallest, the CAC waiver, each of the programs far exceeded the inflation and population growth rates. We also looked at how Minnesota's expenditures for persons with mental retardation or related conditions compare with that in other states. As this table shows, Minnesota is a fairly high spending state on this population compared to other states in the country. On MRRC waiver spending in fiscal year 2002, Minnesota spent $139 per state resident, which is the equivalent of second highest spending among the states in the country. When we combine the waiver spending along with institutional spending for persons with mental retardation or related conditions, Minnesota spent $183 per capita, which is fourth highest among the 50 states. We analyzed two components of these cost increases between 1991 and 2003, and we found that caseload growth is the primary cost driver. Minnesota's Medicaid waiver programs over this 12-year period had increases that ranged from 7 to 30% on an annual basis for each of the five waiver programs, again, far surpassing the annual increases in inflation. Increases in the average cost per recipient were also a contributing factor, but a secondary one. Excuse me. This next slide shows, shows the difference between these two factors. In this slide, the red column represents the increases in caseload on an annual basis, average increases on an annual basis for that 12-year period. And the yellow corresponding column represents the increases in cost per recipient over that 12-year period. And just pointing to that first set of columns for the MRRC waiver, you see that the growth in caseload averaged 16% each year since 1991, whereas the increases in cost per recipient increased 7% on the average each year since 1991. But for each of the programs, the caseload increases far surpassed the increases in average cost per recipient. To determine whether these waiver programs help contain Medicaid spending, we compared the costs of serving waiver recipients with the cost of institutionalization, and we found the following. Three of the waiver programs were designed, as I already mentioned, as alternatives to nursing home care, and we found that they do cost less per recipient than comparable care in the nursing homes. These three are the elderly waiver, the community alternatives for disabled individuals waiver, and the traumatic brain injury waiver. Further, each year since the beginning of the MRRC waiver, which was in 1984, it has cost less per recipient than institutional care. For example, in 2002, the average yearly cost per waiver recipient was $55,000, and this is an amount that includes an amount for group residential housing. This compares to $77,000 per recipient of care in institutionalized setting. So it's a difference of about $22,000 between institutional care and MRRC waiver care.
Ms. Howard, excuse me, if yeah. I may, I looked a little bit ahead and I didn't see anything in there. Your chart that shows the caseload contribution, and that's fairly easy to track because we know we had unlocked waitlists and so forth. But even at 7% a year for the MRRC waiver is substantially higher than what cost of living was increasing in that same time frame. Do you have any insights in your studies as to what sort of contributed to the higher than normal or high, at least higher than consumer price index for those per case increases?
Yes, Mr. Chair, we did look at some of the factors that added that contributed to that. One was that there were certain services added to the mix of services available in the waiver program. Particularly in 1998, five new services were added, and so of course as needs of the waiver recipients indicated, they would take advantage of those services that became available. That was one of the causes.
Thank you.
Last point I wanted to make on this particular slide was that at the same time we see these lower costs for waiver recipients compared to institutional care, the caseload growth in the MRRC waiver was so great that it more than offset any savings that the state may have reaped from reductions in spending on institutional care. And I want to spend a little bit more time on that notion. This slide shows how the caseload changed over the last 12 years. The red section shows the number of MRRC waiver recipients. They increased by about 12,000 individuals during this time period. So even though the number of persons with mental retardation in institutions, as represented by the yellow section of this slide, has decreased over time, the number on the waiver increased so dramatically that it offset the state savings achieved by going toward the lower cost care.
So if I may, on that chart, you and I had a bit of a discussion because to find people who are institutionalized has sort of been shrinking just as your chart shows. And I think you pointed out that that's basically ICFMRs is where the people are. Is the comparison normalized because typically the people we have remaining in ICFMRs, oftentimes it's the more chronic conditions that more require more services. And the people who may be on the waiver may have a little average different profile. Is there any, because you're comparing cost or something like that, but is there a normalizing here for the fact that the people in institutionalizing may, even if they were in the other, would probably require more services?
Mr. Chair, in this particular chart, this is just showing all individuals, regardless of the level of care that they need, so it's basically a head count.
Okay. What you did in your, I think in what you just said to us, so that the average per recipient costs were lower, but that's just a raw cost. That's not adjusted for any kind of acuity of care needs?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. It does take into account the level of services that these people receive, and of course, those that have higher needs are going to have a different basket of services than those that have other relatively lower needs.
Can you, if not now, give some kind of quantification for those differences? And I would be sort of interested in trying both to see just how much that difference is and then also to try somehow to adjust it for the likely difference in service needs in those two different populations.
Mr. Chair, we could provide that information to you.
I would certainly appreciate that. Okay. Thank you.
I want to move on now to the method that the department uses to allocate funds to counties for the MRRC waiver program. In what has become known as rebasing, the department based the 2003 allocations to counties on the amounts of actual claims paid in the prior year. Plus, they made an adjustment for inflation and some other cost factors. The department also allocated money for reserve accounts, which are intended to provide respite services when waiver recipients encounter emergency situations or other kinds of crises. They allocated these reserve accounts within counties' budgets as opposed to being separate accounts as had been the practice in prior years. Another change was that counties exceeding the allocation amount would be responsible to pay for that excess. The effect of the changes for 2003 resulted in a reduction in the total amount of the allocation to counties that in comparison to what they would have received under the previous allocation method. Now, in analyzing this allocation method used in 2003, we looked at four dimensions. The first one was state budget control. And we concluded that this method did indeed reduce spending growth in the MRRC waiver program. Counties did keep spending under their budgeted amounts for the first 3 months of fiscal year 2004. However, the second dimension of our analysis was equity among the counties. And we concluded that the allocation method does not allocate resources to counties in proportion to the needs of their caseloads. And that's for a number of reasons that I want to briefly explain to you. First, because the allocation is based largely on prior year spending, counties that spent prudently in the prior year will receive disproportionately low allocations compared to other counties having similar needs. The counties with the higher spending will be rewarded, while the frugal counties will be penalized. A second problem with using historical spending is that the allocations will not change as the county's caseloads needs change, especially in comparison to other similar counties. So, for instance, counties that have large proportions of children in the waiver program are likely to bear a larger burden than other counties when these children reach an age that they will be moving away from home, because the data show that on an average basis, care in the home is a lower cost form of waiver care than care per recipient in foster care. When those recipients who live with their families 1 year but then move into a foster care arrangement the next make that move, they're going to require higher spending that the prior year's spending levels simply will not recognize. Now, a third reason that this method does not allocate resources to counties in proportion to the needs of their caseloads is due to the department's use of what are known as the profiles. The department assigns waiver recipients into one of four profiles based on that person's functional characteristics. Profile one is at the high end of the scale. It reflects high self-care needs and obstructive behavior characteristics, while profile four on the other end of the spectrum reflects limited self-care needs and small or no major behavior problems. Now, the problem as we saw it is that the profiles do not reflect the large cost differences between living at home and living in foster care. Let me illustrate the differences for you with this figure. This shows that for each of the four profiles, the cost of living at home, which is depicted by the red column, is far less than the cost living in foster care, and that's shown in the corresponding yellow column. The profiles do not take into account these very large cost differences in living arrangements. The remaining two dimensions that we used in analyzing the allocation method were spending incentives and administrative burdens. Regarding spending incentives, because of the reliance on prior year spending, the method creates incentives for counties to spend to their budget maximum. If they spend any less than the full amount budgeted, then they're going to jeopardize the size of their next year's budget. And further, we concluded that the allocation method does impose administrative burdens on counties. Last year, counties did not know their actual allocation until the second half of 2003, which of course makes it very difficult for them to plan for the services and how they're going to distribute the various resources among their clients. Because of the problems that we identified with the methodology, we recommend that the department change its method for allocating MRRC waiver resources to the counties. The new method should improve the distribution of funding by better reflecting the needs of the county caseloads. We think it should also try to avoid incentives for counties to spend to that budget maximum. And further, it should reduce the administrative burden for counties to the extent possible. We believe that legislators and state officials can expect to see ongoing pressures for increased spending on the MRRC waiver program, and for two particular reasons. First, there are thousands of people still on the waiting list for the MRRC waiver. As you can see from this particular slide, the number on the waiting list has increased steadily since fiscal year 2001. There was a three-month open enrollment period from late March through June of 2001, which brought down the size of the waiting list, as you can see on this chart. Since that time, however, the waiting list numbers have gone back up another 30%, so we're now back up to 3,900 people on the waiting list for the waiver. The second reason we think that the pressures for spending are not going to go away is that a large number of children joined the MRRC waiver during this open enrollment period. As these children who are now receiving the MRRC waiver services age and reach the age when they want to or have the ability to move away from home or in some cases have to leave home because their parents can no longer care for them, they're going to move into foster care arrangements, which, as I've already indicated, are far higher costly living arrangements than living at home. So as they do age and reach that point when they move into foster care, they're going to require higher spending.
Ms. Howard, excuse me, on the waiting list a few years ago when we spent a fair amount of time looking at it, part of it was numbers, but the other part of it was the profile of people on the waiting list. And at that time, we found adult children with elderly parents situations which had been on for quite a long time and pretty compelling cases. Did you get beyond just sort of raw numbers, any kind of a sort of a profile of what the members who are on the waiting list look like?
Mr. Chair, we did not. We had looked only at the count, sort of again, a head count of the individuals, and did not break that count down by age or by needs.
That's fair enough. Thank you.
We noted that there are equity concerns arising with these waiting lists because we know that some of the people who are waiting to receive waiver services are likely to have the same level of needs or perhaps even greater needs than those who are currently receiving waiver services. Now, there are options to reduce the waiting lists, but none of these options is a panacea, and in fact, all of them have drawbacks. The legislature, of course, could increase appropriations for the MRRC waiver program, but the state's budget situation has poses certain realities that limit the feasibility of going that route. There are other options. We like to pose them for consideration, but we also think it's important to point out what the drawbacks are. One of the alternatives would be restricting eligibility based on the severity of person's needs or the immediacy of their need for institutionalization. Of course, the trade-off here is that certain persons that have justifiable, very legitimate needs would no longer be eligible for the waiver services. Another option is limiting the services covered by the program, restricting in some way the array of services that are paid for by the waiver. But this diminishes the opportunity for providing services that meet an individual's level of care and own unique characteristic needs. The state could lower spending for the existing waiver recipients, but this is akin to another rebasing. And if we were to do that, this would likely force counties to face another round of dilemmas over how they're going to apportion their resources among very needy individuals. The state could further limit the payment rates to providers. This, however, poses some trouble because whether or not rate controls are an effective way to control costs remains a subject of debate. The state could design incentives to encourage recipients to stay in their homes, which I've already described as a lower cost form of care, but this works against those individuals whose objectives are self-determination and independence and want to have that opportunity to reach self-determination and independence by living away from their families. Another issue that we evaluated was whether there are sufficient controls to ensure that funds are spent appropriately in the waiver. We looked specifically at the component of the MRRC waiver that's called consumer-directed community supports. This component is an option for MRRC waiver recipients only, and only in a limited number of counties currently. It allows recipients and their families to have greater control over what services they receive and who provides them. For instance, it gives them the opportunity to have certain in-home care services provided by family members or friends or neighbors, as opposed to formal service providers, formal Medicaid program service providers. The consumer-directed community supports option has enjoyed a lot of positive feedback from the waiver recipients who have made the decision to use it. And I think if you were to ask many of them, and there have been studies and surveys and focus groups of the individuals who have used this, and they have reported very positive reactions to this option. On the other hand, we concluded that the state has insufficient controls over the consumer-directed services, and I want to explain briefly why we came to that conclusion. First, we identified what we call questionable purchases made through consumer-directed community supports. We, during the study, visited 12 counties. It was just a case study of counties. We examined a random sample of about 170 of their cases, and about three-quarters of these cases included items that the typical MRRC waiver program does not fund. These are things like internet connectivity fees, tax preparation costs, tickets to professional sporting events, things along that line. In addition, about 11% of the purchases that we looked at we labeled as unusual, and we tried to track to see whether there was any justification in the individual service plans for those recipients with these, what we called, unusual purchases. And for 11%, we did not see any indication in the individual service plan of a relationship between the recipient's needs and these so-called questionable purchases. Second, we saw a lot of variation from county to county with the consumer-directed community supports. For instance, some items that are allowed for purchase in one county would be expressly disallowed in another. That, of course, raises some equity concerns. Plus, not all the counties had in place policies that would have allow them to control the use of the consumer-directed option when problems would arise. If, for instance, recipients would overspend, or if there were any indications of fraud, or if a recipient would be in a position that they were compromising their own health and safety, there were a number of counties that didn't have any policy in place to discontinue the use of consumer-directed community supports. And then third, the waiver spending on the participants using the consumer-directed option was higher than average. higher on average than spending for the traditional MRRC waiver recipients. In the large counties where most of the recipients using consumer-directed services are located, the average daily spending on the consumer-directed recipients was 8% higher than the average daily spending on the other recipients with similar needs but using the traditional waiver services. As part of our study, we surveyed the county waiver administrators, and we asked the counties that offered consumer-directed services about the kinds of state assistance that they thought might be useful to them. As you can see from this pie chart, the red slice of the pie represents 82% of those county waiver administrators who told us that they thought requirements on the allowable uses of consumer-directed funds would be very useful to them. So the counties, too, recognized this variation from county to county and what was allowed and what was not. In response to legislation passed back in 2001, the department has recently submitted to the federal government a number of proposed changes to the consumer-directed options. The changes that are proposed would do a number of things, and I'll briefly summarize them. First, they would expand this consumer-directed option to all counties around the state. As I mentioned, right now it's available only in a limited number of counties. Only 33 counties now offer the consumer-directed option. Second, the proposed changes would make the consumer-directed option available to recipients of the other four waiver programs. So now it's limited to just the MRRC waiver program, but under the revisions, if they are approved by the federal government, the option would be available to all recipients of any of the five Medicaid waiver programs. And then third, to cut down on this variation across the counties, the state would impose certain requirements on how the consumer-directed services funds, how the whole program would operate, including how the funds could be spent. For instance, one of the requirements would be specifying certain items that would no longer be allowed. This includes things like membership dues or tickets to recreational events. We recommend that the department add more state controls on the consumer-directed services to ensure that they are available in an equitable manner and that spending on them is appropriate. For instance, we think that additional guidance is needed on what items are allowable purchases under certain circumstances. Because we know, for instance, that in certain circumstances, purchase of a cell phone might be a very legitimate use, but that certainly wouldn't be a legitimate use for everybody that's in the program. We also recommend additional guidance from the state on conditions for terminating use of the consumer-directed option when problems arise. Second, we believe that before the consumer-directed option is available on a statewide basis, the department should evaluate how well its newly proposed controls work. And we think that the department should evaluate how well these controls work in a limited number of counties before the option is expanded statewide. The evaluation would necessarily slow down the implementation of the consumer-directed option on a statewide basis, but we think it's probably necessary to do that in order to clear up problems that might otherwise simply serve to frustrate the users of the program and weaken the entire consumer-directed option. Moving on to the final area that we looked at in the report that I'll be summarizing today, we looked at how well counties complied with certain state rules that govern how the MRRC waiver program operates. We found that for the most part, counties are very good in complying with these state rules. The rules that we looked at in particular are ones that apply to determining and updating waiver recipients' individual service plans and also making sure that the services that are needed are available. However, we did note some exceptions when we reviewed the case files in the 12 counties I mentioned earlier that we had used as case studies. For example, there's a state rule that applies to the need for counties to update each waiver recipient's individual service plan at least annually. Of course, this is an important rule because it's important for the county to understand how the recipient's needs change over time. Most of the cases we examined did have current individual service plans in them. But 6% did not have an individual service plan that was dated within the 12 months prior to our review. One other example that I'll give this morning is that state rules require case managers to conduct what's called a monitoring visit, at least semi-annually, with each of the waiver recipients. Statutes do not define what a monitoring visit is, but if it were defined as a face-to-face visit with the recipient or the recipient's family, we found that 40% of the waiver recipients and their families had fewer than two face-to-face visits with case managers in the past year. And in fact, about 17% of the cases had no evidence of any face-to-face contacts between case managers and waiver recipients or their families.
Right. Excuse me, Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms. Hauer, in those cases, were the counties still collecting case management fees?
Ms. Hauer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, yes, they were. Now, I don't want to suggest that there was no work done on these cases, and in fact, my next statement to you would have been that even though there were no face-to-face contacts between the case managers and the waiver recipients, we did see evidence of other types of contacts, telephone contacts, written communications. So the cases were not, it's not that the cases were ignored. Hmm. It's just that in compliance with this particular rule, they did not adhere.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Did the case management fees reflect, did you assess whether they were reflective of the amount of work done? Because one of the complaints that I have heard is that there's some pretty big case management fees out there in some counties that are being collected and very little is being done to actually manage the cases.
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, for the cases that we reviewed in these 12 case study counties, we did not determine whether the amount reimbursed to the county was equivalent to the amount of time that the case managers or other county personnel spent on the case. What we did look at was over time how changes in costs for particular services changed, and we did see an increase in costs for case management services, and the increase was greater than the inflation rate, but there were other services where the costs over time increased far greater than the costs for the case management services. But specific to your question, we did not go in to verify whether for those particular cases we reviewed, the amount of the case management reimbursement was equivalent to the amount of time spent on the case.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Before I leave this slide, I'll just mention that we do have in the report on page 55, if you're interested, a table that does list the number of contacts between case managers and waiver recipients or their families on an aggregate basis. So, and if you're interested in more information on that, could look at that particular table. Because of the importance in our mind of applying the state rules consistently in the counties around the state, we recommend that the Department of Human Services assess county compliance with state rules that govern the operation of the MRRC waiver program. Now, up until this point, the department has not routinely reviewed how counties administer the programs. They really, the department that is, has become involved with compliance issues only on sort of a need-to-know basis when problems have arisen and problems have been brought to the department's attention. However, the department is planning this year in 2004 to begin reviewing county administration of the home and community-based waiver programs. And we believe that as a part of this review, the department should include an assessment of compliance with these state rules where we found some exceptions to compliance. So, Mr. Chair and members, in sum, our major points in this evaluation are, first, that the state can expect pressures for increased spending to continue on the MRRC waiver program. Second, the Department of Human Services should change its method for allocating MRRC waiver funds to better target these funds to the counties in proportion to their needs of their caseloads. Third, the department should set some additional controls to ensure appropriate spending of the consumer-directed community supports. And it should evaluate these proposed controls, the department's proposed controls, before expanding this option statewide. And finally, the department should take steps to review county compliance with the state rules that govern the MRRC waiver program. The full report does cover a few additional issues beyond what I've mentioned today, and I do want to let people know that the report is available online. I'd be glad, though, to answer any questions you have about the report or the study that we conducted. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions, members? Representative Abel?
Thanks, Mr. Chair, and I have some for the department, but for Ms. Hauer, I have a couple. I want to thank you for your work on this. I spent a great deal of time on this topic last spring and found it to be fascinating and extremely daunting. The level of detail and the size of these programs and the needs of the individuals is just profound, and I think you've done a really good job in the time you had to put together a really good review, and I commend you for your work. As you talk to the, and I appreciate your recommendations, and we're going to follow up on them, you can be sure. In the county comments, the counties that didn't comply with the rules, counties I know generally try to follow rules. Did you discover that they felt like they didn't understand the rules, that the rules are too vague, or that they hadn't enough training in those rules to comply like they wished they could have?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I don't think it was a matter of not understanding the rules. The particular rules that we tried to verify were ones that I think counties felt they understood pretty clearly. I don't think that we could say that same thing about all of the rules because we didn't examine all of them. But in a survey that we conducted of counties, we tried to ask about what were the factors that would interfere with their ability to comply with the rules. And they gave us a variety of answers, but in some cases, they would say, for instance, with the not being able to have sufficient number of visits with the between the case managers and the waiver recipients, they would respond that from a lot of the counties, we heard that just the number of case managers that they have compared to their caseloads, the ratio was so small that the case managers simply didn't have sufficient time to make the number of visits they would have liked to with each of the waiver recipients. There were a variety of other reasons, too, but I think that was, if I recall correctly, that was the reason spoken by or reported by most of the counties in answer to that particular question.
Just one thing else. And to that same kind of point, some of the larger counties have more staff that can be more specialized. Did you discover that the smaller counties with a smaller staffing where they might have one-third of a person's time allocated to one of these waivers or they might do many waivers or a very diluted amount of times, did you see any variation in their ability to comply with that level at that level?
Ms. Howard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, actually, no, the lack of compliance wasn't concentrated in one county. It was spread about around the state.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. When in the last year or so, when some of our budget challenges were in front of us, there was action taken, which was kind of to try to cap. And it looked as though maybe some counties had gotten ahead of themselves in terms of allocating waivers, and for them, the cap was more of a challenge, and we heard a lot about that. Did you, in any of your counties, run into that phenomenon?
Mr. Chair, certainly counties expressed to us the frustration they were feeling because they had a certain number of people who were on the waiver, and they didn't feel they had the resources they needed to provide services. And some of them, as you well know, felt that they had to cut in some way the services that were being provided, either the amount or in some cases the type of services that had been previously offered.
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Hauer, I've got like a three-part question here in reference to the waiting list. First, what are people doing that are on the waiting list and not receiving services? Are they getting services, and how are they paying for them? And then how does someone actually get on the waiting list? And because our standards are different from other states, is that a factor that would allow them to be on the waiting list?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the first question was, are the people on the waiting list receiving services? And yes, they are. If a person is eligible for Medicaid, that person can receive Medicaid services. Being eligible for the waiver entitles them to additional services that a regular Medicaid recipient cannot receive. But because the person is eligible for Medicaid, which is basically a requirement for eligibility, the person will be receiving Medicaid services. In some counties, persons on waiting lists will also receive certain services that the county may be providing, but that's not uniform from county to county. I know that there are some counties where they might be getting some additional services even beyond what the Medicaid state plan offers. Then your second question, I think, had to do with how a person gets on the waiting list.
Right.
And that's a matter of determining whether the person is eligible for the waiver program. Now, when we spoke with county representatives, they made it quite clear to us that they know of people in their counties who are very likely eligible for the waiver, but for whatever reason, those people have decided against applying for waiver services. But many other people, on the other hand, are eligible by the very standards that the state has set out and are simply waiting for an opening to occur. So there are a variety of eligibility requirements. If they meet those requirements, they can be put onto the waiting list. They have to require a 24-hour plan of care. Obviously, they have to have either mental retardation or a related condition, and they have to require the level of care that would otherwise be provided in an intermediate care facility for the mentally retarded. If they meet the eligibility requirements, they will go on to the waiting list. Mm-hmm. But I think that the third question had to do with other states and their eligibility requirements. Now, we did not examine eligibility requirements in the other states, so I really couldn't speak to you about how Minnesota differs. I do know that Minnesota has some differences in the level of services and the array of services that we provide to our waiver recipients. Excuse me, but I just am not knowledgeable enough about the differences in eligibility requirements to answer your question.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilkin.
thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this kind of goes wrong along the same line of questioning, but in the 2001 open enrollment, did you find any number of people that were enrolled that were really truly not at risk of institutionalization?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, we did not look at whether those open enrollment enrollees met eligibility requirements. That was something we simply did not do as part of the study. However, even during the open enrollment period, the eligibility requirements did not change. Counties still had to meet the same requirements, had to determine that the recipient met the same requirements as earlier and then later than the open enrollment period. So eligibility requirements did not change.
Right. Mr. Chairman.
Representative Wilkin.
I understand that, but we don't know if we didn't test in the audit if the counties were actually complying with that law and making sure that they were eligible in that with that test, whether they were at risk of institutionalization or, you know, we don't know the effectiveness of their decision. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, that's correct. We did not test for eligibility. We do know that there are some differences among the population of waiver recipients who entered during that open enrollment period compared to other waiver recipients. For instance, that population contained a large number of children, which I think we already talked about briefly. Another difference is that the percentage of people living at home is far greater for the open enrollment group than others. Another difference is the severity of mental retardation. There are fewer profoundly mentally retarded individuals in that open enrollment group compared to other waiver recipients. So we know that there are some differences, but you're right that we did not, in this audit, test the county's determination of eligibility for the waiver recipients.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Simonson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one more quick question. I was looking at page 35 of the actual report, and it states basically that the MRRC waiver spending is supposed to increase only by 2% over the next, I think it's 4 years. Based on that, how come the waiting lists continue to grow?
Ms. Hahn?
Mr. Chair and Representative, the reason that the growth for the MRRC waiver program is constrained to that 2% level is because of the legislative action taken to limit the number of new openings in the waiver program. So last year, and during the last session, the legislature said we will no longer have an additional 300 openings, which had been the case in prior years. So that was taken away for the upcoming biennium. And that's one of the primary reasons that the growth for this particular waiver program is lower than the expected growth in the other waiver programs.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Samuelson.
Thank you. Even though it's lower than others, these people are still being serviced in other ways in the community. Is that accurate?
Mr. Chair and Representative, they are receiving some level of service. I think that some of them would say not all of their needs are being met because they aren't eligible, not being on the waiver yet, to receive the full array of services that waiver recipients may obtain.
Thank you.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, I would echo Representative Vogler's comments. As is usual, I think, in the reports that we receive from the legislative auditor, it's especially for us engineers, it's full of good information, as objective as I think anybody can be, and well done. I think you've placed some challenges in front of us, but there are challenges that we need to be aware of. Thank you for the good work.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Wilkin has a question.
Just kind of going back to the presentation that shows the difference between our per capita spending and that of the national average in our ranking. Maybe you didn't test for this specifically, but did you get any feel for whether we're attracting caseload to the state of Minnesota from where they're moving here because we have an attractive benefit package?
Ms. Hahn?
Mr. Chair and Representative Wilkin, again, we did not test for that, so I could not answer that question.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Next, Department of Human Services, I indicate that Shirley York will be handling this. Well, I see maybe more. Yeah. And in the meantime, Senator Tremba, would you mind moving the minutes of our February 17th meeting? Senator Tremba's moved approval of the February 17th minutes. Are there any additions or corrections? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. The minutes are adopted. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Shirley York with the Department of Human Services, and I'm the Director of Disability Services Division and the HIV AIDS Division. And my area is responsible for the management of four of the five waivers that were part of the legislative audit review. I want to first thank Jody Hauer and her team for the job that they did on this report. These programs are very complicated programs. They provide an important service. And many of you know that because you've struggled with issues embedded in these programs for a number of years. And I think from our perspective, the legislative audit team took great care and a lot of time to really dig deeply into the program and understand the issues. And I think from our perspective, this report provides to us a very valuable source of sort of independent information that will assist us in the future in making changes to the programs. One of the things, though, that I want to point out that was part of the findings of this report that really is on the very good news side is that these waiver programs have achieved the policy directives of the state as laid out by the legislature. If we look at the population of people with disabilities, we see that 85% of people that we serve in human services are served in community-based settings. And that was the original intent of these programs, was to convert what had been very predominantly an institutional-based system of care to one that provides a broad array and very flexible services, where the incentives were for keeping the person in the community with their families. And so I think that all of you, as we can also, feel very pleased that the programs have achieved its outcome. These programs have also been, over the years, very fast-growing. And what worked when these programs were smaller, obviously, work differently or don't work at all as the programs have grown. And what we have also seen is that the people coming onto the program, because we've achieved, basically, many of our objectives around deinstitutionalization, we are seeing different people now coming onto the program. We're seeing people without that institutional history with different kinds of expectations and different kinds of family needs because they are not coming from institutions. They are living at home and living in our communities already. This audit really did provide for us an independent party to review, and we had been actually going through a process of reviewing a number of our administrative practices and procedures, looking at change. Some of that was certainly reinforced and actually initiated by some of the discussions that occurred in this committee. But, you know, sometimes you're so deeply embedded in something that it's hard to see the forest for the trees. And so we welcomed this opportunity as a way to either verify or tell us differently that some of the things that we were talking about and considering were the wrong road or the right road. We generally view the recommendations and findings in this report to be very consistent with and very supportive of some of the things that we have found and the directions that we're interested in pursuing. And there is contained in the report a letter from Commissioner Goodnow indicating that we do agree with and accept the findings of the audit report and that we will be using the recommendations that are contained in the report as we go forward to make changes, many of which are actually already in process and being made currently, and some of which will be moving into the future. So with that, I know that you have some questions. I thought perhaps if I could open it up to your questions, you may get the more specific kinds of information that you're interested in.
Ms. York, maybe you could begin, because it was indicated in the report that the department's already initiating some waiver changes, extensions. Could you just sort of give the department's perspective on those?
Well, one of the areas that we have focused a lot of attention this past year was in the consumer-directed community supports area. And in this 2001 session, the legislature did pass a mandate for us to expand that service. And we do think that's, everyone thinks, I think, that that's a very good idea. But how to do it has been a real challenge. We've had some experience since about 1998 with counties developing under the option that they have currently consumer-directed services. And so we did spend some time talking with them and with consumers about what worked and what didn't work with respect to those options. I think that pretty much across the board, everyone was agreeing that equity was an issue, that equity around how budgets are set, equity around what kinds of things were appropriate and approved for purchases versus things that were not allowed for was something that they were interested in. The other huge theme that we heard was flexibility, which was basically don't tie us so tightly that we can't create a plan that works for our family or works for our situation, because frequently what will work for one person may not work really well for another person who's in a slightly different situation. So while they wanted definition around what could be purchased and couldn't be purchased, outside of it, within that, they wanted a lot of flexibility to make decisions. One of the positions that the department took was that if we were going to allow a lot of flexibility within sort of a framework of you can buy and you can't buy, then we felt that in order to maintain budget control, we needed a way of establishing limits, because people can bring in a very long list of needs and a very long list of wants. All of them may be very legitimate kinds of things. But from a state budget perspective, both the department and stakeholders who supported the expansion of this told the legislature that we would do it within the constraints of the budget that we had, that it would be budget neutral. So we had to try to balance this flexibility and the likelihood that flexibility would allow people to spend more of the money that was available to them with the need to control the budget scenario and assure that this was truly budget neutral. So some of the key changes that we made as part of this amendment that we have right now sitting in front of the federal government was, first, we did attempt to define acceptable and unacceptable purchases, and that list of things, that definition, would be something that would be required to be used by all counties across the state. The second item, as I that I mentioned, is that family members can be paid for services that we otherwise would hire someone else to pay. There were numerous instances, and this was a policy that a number of consumers and families and advocates have really fought hard for over the years. It's something that's already done under the cash and counseling grants that have been approved by the federal government. And so we pursued, with the help of consumers and advocates, permission in certain situations and under certain conditions to allow the consumer-directed program to pay a parent for services that we otherwise were going to have to hire someone to come in and provide. So there are some very limited circumstances that have been defined. And in fact, in the process of this, the federal government was actually very impressed with the road that we took, and they have now taken Minnesota's version of this and opened it up nationwide to all states that are participating in these waivers. A third big change had to do with the creation of a fiscal entity. One of the issues for us was really program integrity, and can we track what has been purchased, whether it was a legitimate purchase, and assure that the billing and the payments that we make are truly going for the appropriate things. We worked hard with the federal government on how this would work, and we came up with the design that there will be a statewide network of fiscal entities. So even though a family has a budget that they are working with, all of the billing and payments and the assurances that these are appropriate expenditures on a month-to-month basis will be going through what we're calling a fiscal entity. And then the last piece, which is something I already mentioned, was the budget methodology. We decided that the only way that we could assure equity from county to county was for the state to establish a budget methodology so that as people decided to choose the consumer-directed option, the county could tell, no longer had to negotiate with them as to the level of their budget. There would be a budget methodology put into place. And that budget methodology, in that budget methodology, we took characteristics of people, including their living situation, their age, their diagnostic information, a number of critical factors, and we compared, we created groups of similar people so that people with certain types of characteristics would have access to the same average cost as everyone in that group. Well, anytime you're dealing with average costs, you will have people that are above that threshold and people that are below that threshold. But we needed a way to establish what the threshold was and to assure that people on the service and choosing this option would have access to the budget amounts up to that amount, that it wasn't a matter, again, of negotiation, because that really was where the equity issue really continually came up and into play. The other big challenge for us in this, actually, was that this had to be budget neutral, so it had to be a carve-out within the existing budgets of every county. And we had to balance how much activity we thought might be going on in consumer-directed services with the rest of the people on the program in the county who are not in consumer-directed services. So if the state, through the state budget, has sort of created this carve-out for a county, we had to establish the formula at the level that it left the county enough money in the rest of their budget to serve people who do not choose the consumer-directed service option. So we try to achieve that balance, and I know that there is a lot of concern presently because the formula amount that will be available is less than what people wanted it to be. But again, we were trying to actually balance a lot of factors, including offering a budget so that people could have equity but also flexibility within the budget amount that we gave to them. For people who are currently on the CDCS who do not feel that this new budget works for them, that it's not sufficient amounts of money, we have negotiated for them in our amendment that 1 year from their next annual review, they would have that period of time in which to make a decision about whether to continue on the option or to use regular waivered services that are always available to them. Or if there is a concern by the county that the budget amount cannot meet the health and safety needs of the individual, then there is a process in place to allow that person to simply use the regular waivered services, which the regular waiver actually is very flexible. I mean, there are 23 other services in the waiver, everything from residential and in-home family supports to supported employment to special transportation. So while people don't feel that they have as much control in those other kinds of waivered services, we did, again, have to balance the balance between what we could afford to do, what was appropriate to do, and the needs of other people on the program that were not going to be in CDCS. That amendment is currently being reviewed by the federal government. Their indications to us at this point in time is that they are anxious to approve an amendment for the state of Minnesota. And I think that at this point we have answered most of their questions. So it's a matter of going through that federal process. Once the amendment is approved, we have looked at the you know, the recommendations in the report were really to go ahead with a go ahead with an amendment, apply it to the existing counties, but don't expand it beyond those counties until you've had an opportunity to look at and review how the policies and how the new amendment works. We agree that, that really is a wise thing to do. What we intend to do is we will have a six-month period of time in which we prepare and get ready for implementation. We will begin implementation at that point in the counties that are currently participating in CDCS. Concurrent with that, we will be doing an independent evaluation of the rollout, how it's working, what's not working, so that we can get fairly quick feedback about any changes that might need to be made. And then subsequent to that, after we receive those recommendations, we would begin expansion to other counties statewide.
Representative Wilkin.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I got a couple different questions here. You had mentioned that that waiver amendment is going to be budget neutral, and I've seen estimates that show that there's going to be like 1,000 less people on the program. So another estimate I saw was 3,000. It was, came from a consumer that heard it from a county, so I don't know how accurate that one is. But how does that work if we're restricting the amount of uses? That would seem to save money. But then the enrollment's going to go down. That would seem to save money. How does this all work out to be budget neutral, and what are the reasons why those people would be leaving, and are they returning to more expensive institutional-type settings?
Ms. York?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, the people that would be leaving that you're referring to are people that are currently on the consumer-directed program in the waiver, who don't feel that the new budget amounts that they would be offered under the statewide budget methodology meets their needs. Those people would remain on the waiver program. It's just that they would convert to the regular part of the waiver. And the counties would actually then have more responsibility and control over the contracting process, the approval process. There's not quite as much flexibility, although I think that there is significant flexibility in the regular waiver. But the reason why there's no great savings is they're just simply shifting to another part of the same waiver. So and so from that perspective, we don't view that as costing us any less money than what we are spending than we are spending now. Plus, the county continues to have that county budget cap that they have to manage within. So from a state perspective, wherever people shift within the county, there is that sort of firewall, if you will, that the county is still managing within their overall budget.
On that point, I thought in the consumer directed that our costs per individual were less than normally in the waiver. If they made that shift, two questions. One is it really cost neutral? And I think second would be sort of how does that affect our waiver waiting list?
Mr. Chair, actually, one of the surprising things that we found, and it was confirmed by the legislative auditor, was that people on consumer-directed services do not necessarily cost less than people with like need and in like situations. If we compare people that are living in their family home that are not on consumer-directed services to people who are living in their family home and using consumer-directed services, we actually are seeing counties authorize higher levels of budget currently for people on consumer-directed care. And because of the flexibility, people are able to spend more of the money that they are authorized to spend. And so because they can spend it in less traditional kinds of ways, it's just easier to use the entire budget. So when we set the new statewide budget methodology, we had to take into consideration that the spending pattern was different for people on consumer-directed services. And so we did discount, we did do a discount to say we can only afford, you know, 70% of the amount that it otherwise cost us because, number one, we had the counties had authorized more, and number two, people were able to spend nearly 90% of the budget that they were authorized to spend. So in normal services, we typically see that it's more like a 70%. You can spend about 70%. For a variety of reasons, people don't spend their entire budget.
Ms. Yorkberg, if we were successful in sort of that 70% formula and persons then chose to switch to the regular waiver instead, would the cost neutrality for that switch still be effective?
Mr. Chair, no, we don't believe it will. Some of the people that will switch are very high-cost people currently under CDCS. I mean, we looked at the top 250 people in terms of expenditures for consumer-directed services, and we had, we had people at fairly high cost. Those people, we feel, would not cost any less or any more if they used the regular waiver. We made that assumption that at least, you know, if they're costing $300 a day under consumer-directed services, our formula simply cannot reach that high at the current time. We don't have the money in the budget, and to keep it budget neutral, to be able to do that. Those costs could still be available to the person, but they would simply have to spend it within the structure of the regular waiver as opposed to the consumer-directed portion of the waiver.
Senator Wilkin, I sort of jumped in there. Do you have any further questions to follow up?
I did.
I'm sorry.
But all right, you're chairman. You can do that. I want to get back to the county case management fees. And is there any control that you have internally to monitor those and to make sure that the fees that are being charged for case management are commensurate with the services that are being provided?
Ms. York?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, the claim system does, the claim system simply has an edit in place so that above a certain, we will not pay above a certain threshold in terms of a rate per unit that is, that a county would charge. Beyond that, the kinds of monitoring that is done in terms of the integrity of the billing function compared to the actual work is the same for county case management as it is for any other provider of service. We do, however, plan, because of issues that have been raised in this committee and by advocates and even by counties, we are in the process of putting together a review team that will begin reviews, systematic reviews of counties this spring. And it's really the intention is to look at the county practices and the county's administration of the waiver program, including things such as how they bill for services. And in addition to that, we have a lot of questions, too, about county case management system. And in addition to that, in January of 2005, we're scheduled to present a legislative report that also looks at the issue of case management practices, the funding and the incentives for service providing case management services with recommendations for legislative changes. So we are aware that there are probably a lot of questions around this issue that we can't answer currently. And we have periodically looked at county billing, and we've looked at the case records, and certainly we've had federal reviews, But if your question really is, do we have a systematic way of doing that, we have not had that currently. We are in the process of putting together a team.
Representative,
one more thing, and I thank you for that, and I just ask that you keep us up to date on what you find, because we are hearing quite a bit about that. In regard, going back to the question that asked the auditor about the actual qualifications, this is just another monitoring of the, you know, I want to see some kind of state control where you go in and audit or do some kind of review periodically. And have you done anything to see if these people are truly qualified who are getting on the waiver, if they were truly at risk of institutionalization?
Mr. Chair, Representative Wilkin, we do have in place sort of a broad monitoring system in that certain criteria have to be met or the automated system kicks it out. We also do monitor appeals and other things like that to look at questions of eligibility that come up. One of our current focuses, though, is on the issue of eligibility, and we have not done training on that for a few years. And so, beginning in January, we started training again on the issue of, you know, what constitutes eligibility. How do you interpret assessment results that you get whenever you assess an individual's needs? And we have also recently, like within the last month, finished and put online to the counties the code book for screening of people for eligibility with all the policies and the procedures and the formats. And we're going to be out doing training this spring on eligibility for the counties, because it has been a number of years since we really trained on that issue. What we generally find is that counties do a good job. When we do sort of spot checks of these things, we find that they actually do a pretty good job of complying with the requirements of our waiver plan, and which spells out what you have to do to be eligible. We do have some areas where we think certain kinds of diagnoses, such as the pervasive developmental disorders and some of those kinds of things, present more of a problem for interpretation. So there are some of those kinds of areas that are real gray, and sometimes we have found some real sort of outlier data points that we've had to take action on. But it is an area of concern for us and one that we'll be focusing on.
Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Actually, the longer I listen, the more questions get answered, so I can cut my list in about half.
It works good for me.
And I just want to remind members, these programs are somewhere in the range of $1 billion a year just to get the grand plan, and half of that state and half of it's federal. So in the two-year thing, it's $1 billion of state money. So this is a very, very real big piece of our budget. And just to emphasize, when the department talks about 70%, that's the forecasted number. And so if the county spent up to what was allowed, we'd have a huge deficit in this thing. So there's not 30% of money running around waiting in some surplus pot. So I want to commend the department. That would make them happy for once with me. A lot of the things that they're doing, I see as being very responsive to the concerns of this committee and the community at large with the training part. We had addressed that last year, and I think that's wonderful. And I think that they've taken good leadership on that part. And I'm glad they're doing some work with individualized service plans, which is where you identify in. And I won't ask many questions about that, but I'm glad it's underway, and I'm eager to hear the report that comes out, and I hope that the inclusion of that, the inclusionary nature of that report is as broad as it seems like it is, so that's good. And the allocation plan for counties, is that part of, Ms. York, is the allocation, is that all part of that study?
Ms. York?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, actually, that's sort of proceeding on a separate track, but at the same time. And there are two things that we're in the process of doing. One is the in in response to a number of things, including the findings of the legislative audit, we are in the process of issuing a request for proposal. We want to work with a contractor to develop a new allocation structure for the MRRC waiver, and we would like to have that in place in time for fiscal year 2006. You know, we do recognize some of the issues with the current, the way we allocate money currently, and we agree that changes need to be made. I think on a longer term, beyond the next few years, we are also looking at what happens when we have a system that's almost completely non-institutional. What is the entitlement? I mean, the issue for waiver services is that it's an alternative to an institution. The institution is the entitlement, but as we become increasingly less dependent on institutions, the questions for consumers coming onto these programs is, what is the entitlement going to be? We have no institutions, but what is it? Is it everything on my wish list? Is, and if it's everything I need, what does need mean? Because my definition of what I need and your definition of what I need might be two very different things. So for a longer on a longer term scale, we need to have a way of assessing that is uniform. We need a way of assigning sort of the what people are entitled to that provides equity. Not just to people with mental retardation, but to people with any kind of disability. So that really is sort of a longer-term project that we have going on as well.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Baylor.
And I appreciate that, and that's you're on the right track. And some of these changes are controversial, and there's outliers who get injured, or at least they suffer some perhaps harm along the way in the clients. And but it's, I think if we don't, that we're going to be swallowed up by this, and it's... And this, the grouping that you're beginning to do, I appreciate that. I know I pushed for that last year. So a couple questions about the forecast and so on. In the current, you probably can't tell us the secrets about the February forecast, but in the November forecast and your indications in so far, are you in line with what we passed in our budget? I don't remember what November's forecast was. I know the whole department is up farther than expected. Is this, are these waivers up in November and likely to be up again from the forecast?
Mr. Chair and Representative Abler, I think that, if I recall correctly, the November forecast, the MRRC waiver actually went down slightly, and the other waivers, I think there were some adjustments upward. Most of that was, I think, related to caseload growth that occurred prior to the limits that were put on. We had a, as people heard about the legislature talking about the limits, they scrambled to put people on CADI and TBI. And so we did see a fairly large sort of increase in the caseload before July 1st. But since July 1st, things have actually been pretty stable. And I think we're fairly comfortable. We've had a lot of conversation about this inside the department. You know, our goal is to get this predictable and stable so that we can predict what happens and then maintain a stable budget for as long as the appropriation remains on some kind of, you know, sort of like even line. And so I think that we're fairly comfortable that we're positioned to do that now.
Two more questions.
Professor Midler?
And then one thing I hadn't thought of that came out in the auditor's report was the like the 20-year forecast. As these young people now, or even the 25-year-olds, and become 45, and you know, and actually the good news is that some of these clients are living longer. So, but also that's fiscal impact. And have you considered the 20-year forecast and how that's going to consume different parts, and at least given some thought to that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, that really is part of the reason why we want to take this longer-term view of uniform assessment standards and what is the entitlement under Medicaid for people with disabilities, and how will we apportion out the money that is available through the programs. And I think that we'll have to go through several stages of sort of looking. When I first But when I was really thinking about this and talking with people inside the department, it became overwhelming because we know demographically that the clients will change, and we know that the expectations for younger people are very different than the people that we pulled out of state hospitals, you know, in the 1980s and the 1990s. So they want different things from the program, and we have to be able to be flexible enough to make those changes because we're going to see different folks on the program. So that's one of the reasons we're undertaking that and view it as a longer-term project for us to do.
A final question.
Representative Baylor.
Relative to the cost differential of home care versus whatever you call it, institutional care, it's certainly an array of places they can be at. Appears to be a factor of about three times as much when they're out of the home. Is part of your study scope to find barriers to people, to the clients staying in their homes longer or even being there indefinitely? Is that part of what you're doing too?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, yes, we know that actually the most expensive services are the 24-hour, 7-a-day-a-week residential services. And the longer we can keep people in their own home and with their families and with natural support systems, that actually has cost benefit for the state's budget. But we also recognize at certain points people have to make a decision. They can't care for an adult child or there is a desire for more independence. So we are going to have to kind of decide how those factors should weigh into any entitlement that we create for people.
Mr. Chair, just to follow up on that. But I hope someone's looking at the barriers. So what is it, you know, people's desire to have now that the child is now an adult and they want to, both the parents and child kind of want to move on now the child's an adult. But other things that are, you know, availability of staffing and sometimes for lack of one individual that they couldn't hire, the person is going to revert to an institution and so at greater cost and in a less preferable environment. So I hope that would be a discussion too. So.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, sure. If I could just add one comment. I think from the view of many consumers, that's one of the reasons why they like consumer-directed services so much. That because they have more control over the way they spend that money that they've been provided and they can find people and pay people to come into their home and they get more consistency in their staffing and you know they can prioritize what's really important to them versus just what's paid for under medical assistance. So that for us I think holds out hope for the future in terms of that service.
You know, just to, something is sort of trying to be remembered, but I'm not sure. Isn't there another program called Family Support Grants or something, which is essentially state-only money, has a lot of the similarity, but people then accept a fairly amount, a lot less money, but even more flexibility?
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Actually, there are two other programs.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Just to make it more complicated. There is a family support grant program, and that provides a small grant to a family to buy things that MA won't buy for them. But then there's also the consumer support grant program, and that was for people who were on Medicaid home care services that decide just to take the state budget portion of the service, and they use that as a consumer grant. So there is a mechanism in place that transfers money from the MA forecast to the consumer support grant when a person that's on MA home care decides to go that direction.
Thank you. Representative Samuelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This one's quick, Ms. York. With the federal match, it's approximately 50%. Is that accurate? Is there any way that fluctuates based on service levels or new services into the program?
Mr. Chair, Representative Samuelson, no, it does not fluctuate dependent upon the service. For all of our medical assistance services provided to clients, the match is the same whether it's institution or home-based care.
As a matter of fact, I think Representative Samuelson, it's essentially based on the income in the state, and it's adjusted, I don't know how frequently, annually or whatever, but it's strictly based on sort of how well off your state. So there's some states that the match is more in the 75% range, and then we're at the 50% range, but it's just it's only that side of it. It's sort of an index of how well off you are in your state.
Mr. Chair.
Right track? I see heads going this way. That must be good.
Yes, Mr. Chair, that's correct. Dr.
Simonson?
I knew that that applied to nursing homes, but I wasn't sure if it applied to all these services. It's
the same formula across the board in any of our MA.
Okay.
Representative Huntley.
Mr. Chair and Ms. York, I probably don't have enough time today for you to answer this, but I'd be interested in knowing what kind of services people that are on the waiting list are getting versus what they're not getting if they get into the program. And secondly, what's it costing us while they're sitting there on the waiting list trying to get into this program versus what will, I mean, we know it will cost when they get in, but it's not clear to me what additional services they get after they get into the program.
Mr. Chair, Representative Huntley, actually we do have a report that will be submitted to the legislature that includes will answer a lot of the questions that you have about who is on the waiting list. It divides them out by age. It shows what services they're currently receiving.
Good. Thank you. Representative Huntley?
One other question, Mr. Chair and Ms. York. Are the families that have children in these programs, are they subject to a spend down?
Mr. Chair and Representative Huntley, the family income, if when we're talking about children, the family income can actually be set aside if the child is at risk of institutionalization. But what they do pay is a parental fee. And that really is based on, that's based on the income of the family. And I know it's an issue that it's been before this committee. The parental fee issue does apply to people on waiver services.
And Ms. York, that would be TEFRA is how that access is then?
Mr. Chair, TEFRA may be one door, but also for waivered services actually going through that screening process, you do not have to go through a separate door.
Thank you. Further question, members? Seeing none, Ms. York, I have a couple of requests and then sort of a closing comment. Number one, although there's a letter acknowledging the validity of the study, I think it begs the question, especially since there's some fairly specific recommendations as to what the department plans to do in terms of the controls issues, a number of others. So I would appreciate a response from the department as to what the strategy plans and so forth and actually dealing with the specific recommendations. And I would hope that we could get that before too long, just so that we see that. I think somewhat as a springboard from Representative Huntley, I think a lot of us, including myself, we think we understand, but I think we're a long way from really understanding where we spend, because we have all these interrelations. And it strikes me it would be very helpful to have kind of a better picture of our cost per client profile, whether you're sitting on a waiting list or you're in a waiver or you're in CDCS or the other kinds of things that you may be, in actual real dollars. We look at it in aggregate dollars. We talk about $1 billion, but it's a little hard to know more on an individual. And if we could do that, I think it would be very helpful to this committee to get a better picture of sort of what we're investing. Three, I asked a question of the auditors, and I would ask it of the department if you have or could provide this. Anecdotally, at least, and I think you may have even made some comment, the sort of the intuitive, it's less expensive for us as you sort of move up the ladder for the more flexible programs is not necessarily proving true. And I would like to see some comparisons of what are the costs per. For example, one of the things that strikes me I would like to see is whether or not the costs on waiver are really less than institutional. I know it said it from the report from the auditor that on average, but I'm sort of looking for kind of what the distributions look like. I mean, at one time I had the impression that supposedly we weren't even supposed to get there on an individual basis unless that individual was going to be less cost. I don't know if that's the case or not, but I would like to see some comparisons for us as we sort of compare these. That's sort of the informational request. And then I think I'd close, member, with at least my reaction to what we have here. It strikes me that there's a lot of similarity as we had studies on a profile for elderly in Minnesota, and we kind of had this shock of what's going to happen to us when the baby boomers hit us, and if you had the same profile as we do today in terms of services, and I think we sort of all said we'll be bankrupt. And so we've got to change a profile. Plus, I think we also admonished ourselves by saying that the service profile probably doesn't even match what people really want to have. It sort of strikes me that I think we're sort of approaching here. We've been patchworking in the services for persons with developmental disability, the other forms that were under these waivers. But I'm not so sure that it's not time for us to sort of do some legislative and agency kind of real in-depth analysis, just like we did in the elderly area. Let's really understand where we are. Let's understand what our potential liabilities are. Let's understand how well we are. I mean, I think this committee in the last few years has been very much advocates on behalf of these communities of people, unlock the waiting list approaches, those kinds of things. But maybe it's time to step back and to say, I think what I get out of the report is in some respects that if nothing changes, we break the bank. I mean, if we just straight line everything, I don't know if we can sustain that kind of things. I don't know if we can continue to sustain an average of 23% per year growth. And I think we all want to make sure that we are investing as smartly as we can, that we're doing the right things in terms of services. And I don't think it'll happen unless we really decide that maybe it's time for like we did with long-term care, where we had sort of a legislative administration kind of task force and sort of began to better understand what the profiles look like. So I don't have that really shaped, but I think if I can sort of share that notion with my colleagues as well as with the agency, it just seems to me that we're being reminded that we're going to have to be a lot more thoughtful as we move forward in order to make sure that we're getting the best value, that we're doing the right things for the people that we're trying to serve. That's my two cents. Amen. Anybody react? We can take a vote?
We agree.
All right. Well, I appreciate from the legislative auditors and from the department a very, very important update, in which I think is going to take our continuing attention. Our meeting on Tuesday at this point is planned to hear bills on the additional capital investment requests. A fair amount of that part will be with the Veterans Home Board with the bills from them. However, there are a couple of others. We are reaching the point, I think we've reminded you and asked you to remind your colleagues that we're reaching the point in terms of timelines where it would be too late if people don't have their bills submitted that would have to come through this committee. We will then be doing our ranking before we turn those around as recommendations to the Capital Investment Committee. Representative Weber?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you want to think of some more projects this weekend we should buy?
No, thank you.
I have an announcement. The subcommittee for licensure will be meeting, as you already know, Monday, a half hour after session, to discuss the Emergency Health Powers Act reauthorization. And I know a lot of lobbyists aren't here, but many of you are. What we're looking for, just to reiterate, are specific thoughts about how we can make this work better based on the index of SARS. But on Tuesday at 3 o'clock, we'll be meeting again to either continue testimony. I think we'll meet about 2 hours on the Monday meeting just to be humane. And so our attention will be held, because we do want to have some serious substance to that. If we don't get through our list, we'll continue at 3 o'clock on Tuesday. If we get done with our list, we'll move into some of the licensure professional board issues. If you have any board issues that you wanted to bring, there'll be an omnibus. We'll be using a dental bill as the vehicle, we think. It's yet to be numbered. And after that omnibus ship sails that committee, that will be the ship. So we'll be dealing with the dental issues, nurse issues, Department of Health licensing, technical, acupuncturists, alcohol, drug counselors, podiatrists, PAs, and the Board of Behavioral Health matters on that omnibus. So if we left you off the list, you want to do something, let me know. Otherwise, I think we got every board on earth.
Is there anybody left?
I don't know.
I would also remind members that you have a handout that was placed from the Fiscal Analyst Department with some inserts for your capital investment book. on the Minnesota Department of Human Services Agency relocation expenses, and then the Veterans Home Board. So you may, if you've got your book, want to be sure to insert those. Nothing else for business? We're adjourned.